back in open session, I just want to note that Clarence left the table. But we are back in open session and we have a quorum. The case we're discussing is agenda item 6F1 P20028, Paul Stover. And the action is proposed summary suspension of registration. So I will look for a motion.
Can we, Melissa, can you let us know why the case was put in on the packet for summary suspension, given that he's incarcerated?
Right. This actually appeared last month on the agenda. You were unfortunately not with us at the time. And there was some discussion from the members at that time that they wanted to summarily suspend this individual so he could not practice architecture from his prison cell. And I believe the discussion was largely about the public perception of the safety of architects, and perhaps, I speculate, and correct me if I'm wrong, members who were here, that you had concern that a felon was still able to hold themselves out to the public as a registered architect. So there was some concern about public health and safety in that regard. And so it was actually the board directed staff to put it on the agenda for a possible summary suspension. Which, of course, does not limit you to actually taking that action if you feel something lesser should be done, like simply referring the case to formal hearing.
Right. And I think the additional question that's come up is, has he actually violated a board statute by his actions? I sort of think that he has, because I think, you know, his inability to make good decisions could reflect in his professional life, but I understand the argument otherwise in the other direction. I don't know, I sort of think that it may be more appropriate to try to impose probation of his license instead of taking it away, that, you know, if he were to violate any terms of his probation, that would tend to show even more lack of judgment and, you know, ability to practice if he can't maintain his...
Well, how long is he in for?
2.5 years.
2.5 years, but he's got 5 years probation after that, longer probation beyond his...
So how long has he been in now?
Oh, like 2 months. I think he was sentenced.
So, Dr. Angel, I think the question, if I see it right, really the question in front of us is, do we... summarily suspend this person, or do we run through the normal process and suspend his license or some other action?
Or something else, yeah.
And
yeah, I think, you know, Dr. Angel makes a good point in that while he's incarcerated, and not to suspend his license, but to put on notice that his license is on probation until such time as maybe he's released from prison or I don't know how to use what words to use to just demonstrate that you know he has been remediated,
reformed and rehabilitated.
Reformed and rehabilitated, that his license should stay on probation and not be suspended because you know. We don't have an infraction of any board statutes per se, but we do have a character question.
Just for the record, there are violations of the Board's Practice Act. I'm sorry they're not as overt as they might otherwise be, but I think the law pretty clearly holds there's a violation of 32.145.6, otherwise violates any provision of this chapter, which if you look to our rule of good moral character and repute, this individual has violated subsection 12A, has been convicted of a felony as defined in ARS 13601. So okay. I think consideration for the fact this man has a felony conviction and is in prison is a question of moral character under our rules and statutes. Mm-hmm. So I believe you do have authority. Whether you choose to exercise it is up to you and in your discretion.
So I don't think it rises to the level of a summary suspension, especially given his condition right now. I do think it's worth looking into, and, you know, if probation is the right thing or if something else is the right thing to do, a letter of reprimand, whatever it is, we should probably look into that,
okay,
in my opinion.
And just so you know, all of subsection 12 in the rule, R430-101, subsection 12 talks about, you know, the good moral character, and the D actually says is not currently incarcerated in a penal institution. So there's a violation pretty directly of our statutes.
So, I mean, at a minimum, that he should be held on probation until he's released from a penal institution from practicing a registered profession.
But he should be on probation beyond that.
It may very well be, but yeah. I'm just speaking at a minimum.
Yeah.
Right, but I think what you're saying, Jason, is that's not for us to decide today. Today we're deciding whether to do a summary suspension or to move some other way, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way I see this action.
I would not feel comfortable with summary. I think there's due process, and the threat to the public is limited given his situation.
Understood. But I think it's a worthy discussion,
mm-hmm, yeah,
that you're having.
So do we need to take action, or do we just direct staff to look into what the appropriate...
If you wish, you could vote to just forward the case to formal hearing. It would go on the hearing list, and a complaint would be drafted, obviously notice sent to him, and then facts would be fleshed out, and you could determine a resolution later. That seems worthwhile.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Are you comfortable?
Wait, Mr. Donald?
If I may, just to make sure I'm clear in my mind, then, so the board is thinking of R430-101-12, good moral character and repute.
Correct.
And which section is that?
A and D. A says shall not have been convicted of a felony, and D is not currently incarcerated in a penal institution.
Right, but what section is that good moral character and repute definition referring to? What section is being violated?
32.145.6, violations, otherwise violates any provision of the statute.
And this chapter?
If I may, I recommend before the board voted to the hearing track.
There's also 32.128, violation of this chapter or board rules, which is disciplinary action statute. So,
if I guess the board could vote on the summary suspension today and possibly end discussion of actual violations in the next meeting, just to provide board staff and legal counsel to review possible violations in the case.
Okay. I would move that we not impose a summary suspension, but that we direct staff and AG to look into what action should be taken based on 32.128, I like better, and then how it relates to the board rules of good moral character and repute.
Dr. Angel, would you be comfortable amending that motion? Don't narrow it to one thing, because we really don't know the law. I don't. So,
yeah.
Just the law, I guess.
Yep.
Thank
the
you.
Law.
Yeah.
Yes.
La
ley. That's fine. What the right violation would be, or if there's a violation.
We have a second.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Stephen, I saw that you had your hand up earlier when several people were going. Is there something that you wanted to address?
Well, the question I was going to have was, if we went through a public hearing, what information can we get that we don't already have?
That's a good point.
Everything's out on the table of what he's done, so what... And then if he has to be some sort of defense and he's in jail, then he'd get a public defender, and I mean, it's just... What would he get out of it?
Well, he would have the opportunity to be heard, whether that's in person, telephonic, or in writing, when we send him a complaint notice of hearing. He, with that opportunity to be heard, could submit a statement of remorse. He could provide additional factual information. He could, who knows, really provide a plan for his own intended rehab after he's out of prison, that he's done something to ensure his firm is practicing in compliance with our laws. We don't know, but that's the reason for providing notice and an opportunity to be heard at a formal hearing. And at the same time, the board would be looking at the evidence that staff has gathered, which includes his conviction and pre-sentence report information. And then with all of that information, obviously you can determine if discipline is required, and if so, to what extent, given what you're able to do under your disciplinary law.
I think there's also one more benefit to going to administrative judge instead of the board, which is, I think the violation here is not crystal clear. You know, whether it's that, in Melissa's mind it is, I think.
Yes.
Mr. Donald's not so much. So I think instead of the board, you know, taking a stance on it, it'd be good if a judge found whether it is or isn't, and then we decided based on that what the appropriate penalty was.
Sure.
Very good. I like that. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
And I need to look at this motion. Dr. Angel moved and Mr. Noel seconded to not summarily suspend the respondent's license and direct staff to discuss with the AAG the possible violations in this matter. So that's what we're voting on. All in favor to not summarily suspend and do the other things?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. Thank you.
We always get confused when they have a not.
Okay, that concludes, according to my records, all the enforcement matters. Does anybody need a break other than me? Let's take a 15-minute break here and report back at 11. Call the meeting back to order. Again, Clarence isn't at his seat, but
yeah,
we still have
him. Leave the meeting, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Guy.
Melissa, would it be appropriate to have our guests speak now?
Sure.
Okay, and that is 9A?
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, so we'll move on to item 9A, and this is the visit with and presentation regarding the IPAL by the National Council of Architect Registration Boards. And I think as part of this, we have a familiar face in the crowd, don't we?
Who is it?
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you.
Oh, no way.
It's not Madison, it's the other one.
It's the other, yeah.
So, the floor is all yours, folks, and thank you for coming.
Good morning, I should say. Mike Armstrong, I'm the Chief Executive Officer at NCARB, and I think, except for Ms. Wyckoff and Mr. McAllister left earlier, the rest of you were on this board when I last visited 4 years ago. And of course, you know your former colleague Ed Marley, who's sitting next to me, who's the current NCARB Region 6 director, who sits on our national board. I was talking to Melissa during the break. This specific item is narrowed to the discussion of IPAL, but actually, we're here just to talk more broadly about, you know, what's going on and take questions. May we do that during this portion? Or would you rather restrict this portion to the IPAL discussion only and then come back during the reports?
It's fine. It says visit with and presentation on IPAL.
Okay. Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
Is it all right now?
Visit,
yeah.
For you.
Okay. And then Ed can also talk to you about what's going on at the regional level and sort of offer commentary as we go along, I guess. Well, first of all, I send you greetings from our president, Terry Allers, and the NCAR board and the staff. And with me today are two of our assistant vice presidents for council relations, Nefertari Carver, who is here. Go ahead and wave. She sort of has the internal focus on focusing on supporting our member boards, working with our volunteer committees and the appointment process. And then on the other end is Marta Zanevsky. And Marta is our other assistant vice president for council relations. And she has the external focus, working with outside organizations such as the AIA and other related collateral organizations, and as well as looking at advocacy issues, monitoring legislation, and looking for ways to partner to make sure that the interests of our member boards are being appropriately protected and defended. So since all of those issues exist here in Arizona, we thought it would be helpful to bring them both along on this trip. And normally Joshua Batkin, their boss, the vice president for council relations, is my traveling companion. So they don't often get out of the office to visit a state licensing board meeting. So it's also really a good exposure for them, because we have 55 of you, and you all do things a little bit differently. So, but it's really great to be here.
But we're the best.
Of course. I say that to all my favorite boards. just to give you a quick overview of things, NCARB this year has been tackling a few new areas in terms of policy discussions. And I'll talk in a minute about how some of those have manifested themselves in draft resolutions that will come before the membership. We also are doing a lot of work in monitoring the interest and the national debate really about the role of government and the role of regulations. And we are pleased to tell you that in many quarters we're seen sort of as a leader in promoting a more agile and streamlined approach to licensure that still protects the rigor, or when I say rigor for a reason, our ability to streamline existing programs while still making sure that the path to licensure protects the public is something that we've worked really hard on, and we now see other organizations nationally following our lead, and we hope that as our story can be told to broader audiences, we can all realize that there is a balance between regulation and access to employment and some of the other issues that are being debated around the country. We have this year several resolutions coming before the membership at our annual business meeting, which will be in Austin, Texas in June. Our resolution process involves most often a review process conducted by a committee of volunteers appointed by the president, and sometimes it takes more than a year to for things to become ripe for a resolution. But this year we have several proposed resolutions, one of which has been worked on for 4 years, and that is the overhaul of the model law and model regulation document. This document is, of course, merely advisory. It has no legal impact. It would have to be adopted or adapted by you. But we offer it as a tool. So as you are periodically looking at statute or law or rule or reg, that you have a model that you can consult that represents national consensus of what is believed to be best practice. Of course, architects and some other professions, but not many, benefit from the fact that there are uniform laws across state jurisdictional boundaries. So you are very mobile compared to a lot of other professions that would have to retake exams or find other administrative impediments to licensure. The model law document, if you were to visually look at how it has evolved over the past half century, it would look like a patchwork quilt, or maybe more appropriately, lots of band-aids on top of it. You know, a section gets looked at by a committee, and then they fix it or they update it. Another section isn't looked at all. And so what our task force started doing 4 years ago is they said, what if we started from scratch? What if we took a template, in this case by the organization we are a member of, the Federated Association of Regulatory Boards, all the NCARBs, of all the occupations and professions that are out there. Look at that template and see how our model law flows versus that template. See what's in the template that we are missing or that we don't need anymore. And what we discovered is that the flow of our model law document is really dated, and it's not even written in legislative-friendly language. So reducing the words, reordering the flow, and getting rid of duplication was something that the task force has worked on for 4 solid years. There's no new policy initiatives being slipped into this resolution, and that's important to note because it's a big document. And I know some people are getting out their magnifying glass to see if NCARB's sneaking something in there, but it truly preserves all of our programs as they currently exist, all of our processes as they exist, but tries to write it in more succinct, legislative, logical language. And as a result, it's going to be a much smaller document. It's going to be a reduced word count. It's going to be a more available document to use if and when. And it may take many jurisdictions over a decade before they resource this document. But we think it's time to modernize it. So the task force has been working at this for 4 years. We sent a draft of part one, which was the law, out in the fall for first reaction. And we just sent out the rules or regs model, I think a week or two ago. What happens in terms of our process is that we have a regional meeting coming up next week. We use that as sort of a focus group or sounding board on what members think so far of the drafts they have seen. And then based on that feedback, our board of directors at their April meeting will make a final decision. Should the resolution move forward onto the docket in June? And if so, should it be revised from what we sent out earlier? So they're really counting on feedback at the regional summit or separately individual commentary from each of our member boards before we get to the April board meeting. That's probably the most voluminous resolution, the one that probably, if you were to print it out, would land with a thump on your desk, perhaps. We have several other resolutions that I would call more in the housekeeping context. We have a recommendation from the Education Committee to have a clearer process in place for people who don't have a degree from a NAB-accredited program and want to get an NCARB certificate. These are people that are already licensed. You in Arizona, you are one of 18 states that can license people without an accredited degree. And post-licensure, we want to make sure the certificate's available to everybody. So the qualifier to make up for lack of education is extra experience. But some education can still count. And a little more clarity around what is a pre-professional degree and how does that count toward education as a qualifier for the certificate. The Education Committee is wanting to fine-tune that resolution a little more. We also have a resolution from our Interiors Task Force. 2 years ago, this task force was set up to look at the issue of schools that were using the degree title of Interior Architecture. These were interior design programs, but they were conferring a degree in interior architecture, which we felt was causing confusion in the marketplace, perhaps misleading students into thinking they were getting an architecture degree. We had several members who were concerned that this issue, when it had been addressed 10 or more years ago, didn't come to a full resolution, so the task force was stood up to look at this issue to see if there was any legal path to stop schools from conferring these degrees. We determined that legally we can't regulate degree titles, but we can try to make sure that the interior design academic community doesn't mislead the public into thinking that these graduates can call themselves architects. As the task force started talking, it became clear that there was a resolution that had been adopted 20 years ago this year by the NCARB membership that the task force felt needed to be revisited. 20 years ago, in the year 2000, the membership voted to direct the NCAR Board of Directors to work to prevent any effort to license interior designers in any state in the U.S. and to assist any of its member boards in fighting an effort to license interior designers. The Interiors Task Force believes that this resolution is an overreach. The NCAR really shouldn't be speaking to the authority of the state to regulate other professions. That it's not really what NCARB's role is, and quite frankly, in the 20 ensuing years, a number of jurisdictions haven't necessarily licensed interior designers, but they have credentialed them. And so the resolution itself really had no impact. It was never acted upon. It never really was used in any way. And it is seen now as a sort of a misstatement on governance in terms of what NCARB's role is. And we understand that the whole conversation about where do interior designers fit within the context of public protection is a controversial issue. It's emotional. It's fraught with past history that have created a lot of barriers toward any kind of a resolution. But our task force doesn't believe that maintaining this resolution on the books is helpful. And so the recommendation to the NCARB board was to sunset this resolution, and the NCARB board has agreed with that recommendation. So that is another resolution that is on the books for a possible vote in June. I have started having conversations. I mentioned this to Tina this morning from AIA Arizona, and I've spoken to some of her colleagues around the country. We understand that those that are fearful of inappropriate credentialing of interior designers may read this resolution as a signal from NCARB that it is tacitly approving licensure of interior designers as a concept. And our statement of support is going to make sure that everyone knows that's not the case. Moving back to a silent or neutral position on this issue, we think better positions NCARB to focus on public protection rather than protection of the profession. We'll leave protection of the profession to the professional societies. We are in conversation with the Council on Interior Design Quality regarding how, in many cases, they have representatives on our state boards, and how can we have an adult conversation about the commonalities and the differences, and where does that land in terms of regulation. That conversation will be ongoing for the next year or more. But we know that this might be an eyebrow raiser for some, but the board feels that we are at a place as an organization where we need to get ourselves going in a more appropriate direction for a regulatory group.
So Mike, does Oklahoma have licensed interior designers, or are they just credentialed?
I know Nevada has licensed interior designers. I want to say Oklahoma is just credentialed, but don't hold me to it. Do you know, Nefertari?
It's credentialed.
Who licenses besides Nevada? Do we have any others?
Texas, Louisiana, and D.C.
Four out of the
55. And it's interesting, I was talking to Greg Ernie last year, that Nevada has licensed residential architects. Do other states have that?
No, they're the only ones that do that. They have an exam. In fact, we just won a bid to take over supporting that exam. But they're the only state that licenses residential design.
Seems that that's suspect for crossing over, you know, the residential guys moving into the commercial category. Are there a lot of cases, Ed? Getting busted?
Ed Marley, Region 6 Board of Directors.
Really? Really?
Thought
you changed your name.
In Nevada, they came up with both interior design and with the residential design registrations and certifications. they came up with very specific parameters and boundaries for each of those disciplines that really defines very clearly the line that they will they have to cross, and then they end up having to hire a registered architect or engineer or something like that. I know a lot of the interiors part of it falls under a square footage limitation, but also anytime there's any kind of fire-rated construction involved, they have to stop, get a registrant involved if they're going to deal anywhere with fire-rated construction. And that would be a firewall or something like that if they're crossing that or penetrating. On the residential design side, I really don't know what their code is like. We used to have a copy of what they call their rule book here in the office. Melissa, I don't know if we still have that, the Nevada's rule book, because it clearly defines, it's a great piece, and it clearly defines the parameters of all of those areas of practice, including architecture and engineering and everything, what the role of building officials are and everything. It's a great book. I think every state ought to have something like that. But hopefully that answers.
So what about a condo tower? That's residential, residential units.
I suspect there's really clear parameters on the scope of residential. I think residential, I think it's limited. Like our residential exemption, where it's limited to three units or less.
Okay.
I think that's how Nevada's law is written, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you.
We also sent out a couple of weeks ago for comment a proposed revision to our education standard. When NCARB sends something out for comment, that means that the decision is at the board level rather than a membership vote, but the board solicits member comment before it makes its final decision. So in this case, the NAAB, the National Architectural Accrediting Board, has just issued its new conditions for accreditation. Our education standard tries to track those conditions and be similar, and now that they've changed their conditions at the NAAB, we need to change our standard. So the proposal that you have for comment is, are you comfortable with these changes? So there's a 120-day comment period, and then the board of directors can vote on changing the education standard. So that's also out for your review. President Allers also established this year a new licensure advisory forum, which it's not a committee, it's not a task force, it's a forum. It's the idea is that for a number of years we had a experience advisory committee where the AIA and a number of other organizations sat in an advisory capacity to comment on the IDP and then its successor program, the AXP, and give us feedback from their perspective on how they engage with emerging professionals. The idea is that really, why don't we open up the conversation more broadly to all NCARB programs and recognize there are many organizations that might need clarification or have constructive criticism or might otherwise want to dialogue with us about how our programs can continue to grow and evolve and best serve everyone. So the new licensing advisory forum takes a number of the same participants. We have someone from the AIA case community, Corey Claiborne, who is the executive director of AIA Virginia. We have a member of the AIA Strategic Council at the national level. We have representatives from the Academy, the ACSA, Associated Collegiate Schools of Architecture, the AIS, the American Institute of Architecture Students, the Society of Design Administrators. There is such an organization, a number of larger firms, where they are vesting their senior administrative staff with much of the support work that maybe the smaller firm, the architect, would do. They have a national organization, and so they are part of this conversation. And I know, Marta, we've got several other groups that are represented there, too, that I'm not remembering.
AMA and Sarah.
That's right. Some of the smaller professional societies, the Association of Licensed Architects and the Society of Registered Architects, Sarah. What we're trying to do is demonstrate that NCARB is unafraid of being transparent or constructive criticism. We think that's a sign of a healthy organization. We're proud of what we've achieved and how we've grown and evolved, and we want to address rumors as well as criticism. So Terry launched that initiative this year, and our past president, Dave Hoffman, is chairing that effort. And then the other new group he launched is the Policy Continuum Advisory Committee. This takes the chairs of our education, experience, examination, and policy advisory committees and puts them in a super committee because we believe that some of the emerging issues around the regulation of architecture transcend programmatic boundaries, that they really cross over in a strategic way, and that strategic conversation with all of these volunteer leaders can perhaps advise the board of directors on how to address new issues as they emerge. We also are continuing with our Futures group, which is now called the Futures Collaborative. This is composed of some member board members, but it's also purposely populated with other volunteers that might not normally volunteer for NCARD, people who come from large firms, perhaps a more geographically diverse group, people that are dealing with cutting-edge approaches with technology and the practice of architecture, and being provocative in suggesting how some of our ways of measuring competency might change over the years, including, are the three E's still relevant in terms of the steps toward licensure, which is really mind-blowing stuff, and I know that that's contrary to what NCES and NCARB and all the other groups have embraced for most of their lifetimes, but for regulation to remain relevant and to remain agile and to remain responsive to what the public expects from the practitioner, I don't think we can afford to ignore what's happening out there in the field. So hosting those conversations, listening to their ideas, contributing to how a new approach might occur, maybe it's not for another decade or so, but to start the conversation we think is healthy. Yes, sir.
What's the third E? The third E, you said three E's?
Education, experience, examination.
Examination, okay. I was thinking of Asbox, I didn't.
We had projected last year that we might be in a deficit year this year. We have an accrual budget, which means on paper we always have money in the bank, but in terms of how we have to report it to the IRS, we would show an accrual deficit. What's happened is something that we had no history to predict, which is that usually what happens after a new exam launches, and we're now just in ARE 5.0 and we've been there for over a year, usually there's a big drop in examination deliveries. People are nervous, they don't understand the new exam, it takes a while, it ramps back up. And that usually takes several years. And historically that's happened every time we've introduced a new exam. Well, this time that didn't really happen. And we're still not sure why. We're trying to do some more digging and come up with some different measurement tools. One thing that was different is that we had a 18-month overlap between the two exams. So that allowed people during that time period to do a shortcut where they took part of the old exam and part of the new and they could get done faster. We also, several years ago, reduced the wait time. Instead of waiting 6 months to retake the exam, now you only have to wait 60 days. We also are giving instant unofficial test scores in the test center before you leave the test center. So we've added all of these things to create a sense of movement and immediacy to the exam experience. And then we put the exam fees on a schedule so that every other year there's a slight cost of living or whatever you would want to call it, increase to the fee. For the first time ever, we allowed people to pre-book exam time before the fee went up. So the sum result, and of course we have a very healthy economy right now, so many firms around the country are desperate to hire. They're very busy. They're at full capacity. We also are seeing, for the first time in our history, the majority of people in our experience program starting a record while they're still in school. So the exam, the registrations did drop after the new exam was introduced, but the drop was not as precipitous as it has been in the past. So therefore, the ramp back up has been faster. So rather than showing a deficit, to the good, we were off in terms of predicting how many exam deliveries we were going to have this year. We've delivered a lot more exams than we thought. So instead of being in an accrual deficit, we're actually we're in the black this year in the accrual budget as well as the operating budget. So that's a good news story. It allows us to continue to provide services to all of you, to come up with new services that will benefit you. We think it's interesting that we are continuing to see us perform at record levels in terms of exam deliveries, record levels in terms of people in the AXP, and record levels of NCARP certificate holders. We now have about 46,000 certificate holders out of 115,000 registered architects. So that ratio of certificate holder to licensed architect is increasing. I think more and more people are seeing the value of being mobile around the U.S. And of course, we have our mutual recognition agreements with Australia, New Zealand, and Canada that the NCARP certificate facilitates. So it's a positive story I want to share with you in terms of our financial stability and our ability to provide service. Melissa and her team, I hope, have been the recipients of a re-engineered process in our customer relations department so that we are expediting transmittals. We have assigned a staff person to be your liaison so that you can cut through any delays and get right to the heart of the matter. And we also have a tracking system, so when you do find errors, it immediately gets posted to us so we can look for trends and make sure that we're embracing continuous improvement within our customer relations department. And based on our conversations at lunch yesterday, it sounds like you're all satisfied with what we're doing at the service level.
And we also really have appreciated, they invited Rob to come and be part of a committee that looked over all the NCARP certificates, which we fondly call blue covers. So Rob went to D.C. for several days not long ago and met with some colleagues there and reviewed the blue covers.
We've embraced the idea that not just Melissa and her colleagues should be at the table, but really Rob and his colleagues should also be involved, that we need to reach deeper into the staff levels of our various member boards. I personally have been trying to convene a virtual community of legal counsel for all of our boards. As a recovering lawyer myself, I feel that there's an interesting conversation going on nationally about enforcement, ethics, which you just talked about earlier today, investigation, statutes versus regs, how this new model law product might or might not be useful. And I know a lot of the attorneys for the boards around the country are stretched thin and don't have time to physically convene, but if we can at least figure out a way to be in conversation with each other and create a sense of community, I think that's going to benefit us nationally as well as individually. And then I'll talk about IPAL for a moment, and then Ed, you may have some stuff from the regional level you want to talk about too. So I talked about this when I was here 4 years ago. We were just in our, I think, second year of doing it at that point, the integrated path to architectural licensure. So back to this 3Es earlier. Historically, I think in most professions, not just architecture, the belief has been that you pursue these 3Es sequentially. Get your education done first, then get your experience, then take your exam. Well, our NCAR by the Numbers publication, which you get every June from us, indicates that despite all of the streamlining that we've worked on, we've reduced AXP by one-third, we've reduced the exam by one less exam, we reduced the waiting periods, we've reduced fees, we've done a lot of other things, it's still taking the average licensure candidate for architecture in the United States over 12 years to get a license. For most people who hear this for the first time, people that I talk to who aren't in the world of architecture, social friends, people at church, whatever, they just can't believe it. Why does it, as an attorney, you know, I got an undergraduate degree, I got a 3-year JD, and then I passed the bar. Boom, I'm practicing law.
even medicine seems to go at a faster track than architecture. So we created this task force a number of years ago, the licensure task force, to figure out, is there a different model that would not sacrifice any of the rigor, but address the time that it takes? So the solution was, and this requires a partnership with the school, if an academic program is willing to realign its curriculum so that while you're in school, they will place you in a paid job in a firm, so you're earning experience credits under AXP, and you can do all of your AXP before you graduate, and then create time while you're still in school to take each division of the exam once. You don't have to pass it, but at least take it once. And then graduate, you are much closer to being eligible for a license. But that means that state licensing boards would have to be willing to allow people to get a license who took the exam before they graduated. So we adopted a model law that we pushed out to our 55 members saying, we'd like you to consider adopting this as an exception to your rule, that only if you're in IPAL could you have an exam be valid if you take it before you graduate. Now, we recently looked at your rules and looked at your regs and reconfirmed this with Melissa yesterday, that Arizona, as is its want, is a little unique in this regard. You don't have a clear statement that says the examination cannot be honored unless it's taken after graduation. Instead, you say that you can't take the exam until you have 60 months of education or experience. Translate that into, that's roughly 5 years. If you have a BArc, that means you're out of school with a BArc. So it's a de facto prohibition against taking the exam while you're still in school. Technically, no, because you could still be in school. You could be pursuing an MArc, or maybe you got some experience and then took a break and then came back. We know that both AU and ASU seem to be interested in IPAL. Right now, neither of those schools are an IPAL program. We have 21 schools and 26 programs, because some have both their BArc and their MArc in IPAL now around the country. Some of them are near Arizona. We have a number of schools in California and one in Arizona that are IPAL schools. It's possible that an individual that plans to practice in Arizona is going to school in some other state and wants to come back here and practice, but because they took the exam while they were in school in California or Oregon, and they come back here, you're going to say you're not eligible, because you didn't wait until you had 5 years, 60 months under your belt before you took the exam. So I'd like you to, I know you're not ready to have any kind of a robust discussion on this today, but I'd like to plant the seed, and we'd be happy to come back and talk about it some more, or give you some more written materials, or give you some examples of what some of your fellow boards around the country have done with this issue. But we think that this is a way to address concerns from your governor and other governors around the country who are concerned about regulatory impediments to access to employment. It also gets to underrepresented groups in the architecture profession who, because of socioeconomic conditions, might find post-graduation more impediments. And if they can get this all done before they graduate, they're better positioned to get a license. There are a lot of economic arguments for this and sociological arguments for this. And we think it's an experiment worth trying. Certainly a number of students that are in the IPAL programs find it too rigorous, and they end up going back into the regular track. And that's okay too, because at least they've tried and at least they've got more experience under their belt. And the marketplace will help decide whether they're really qualified to practice. I mean, if they are able to pass the exams, if they get all their experience, they get their education, but they did it in 5 or 6 years or 7 years instead of 13 years, then, you know, if
Ms. Wyckoff or Mr. Jones want to hire these people, that's a business decision that they make. It's not a regulatory issue, and that's sort of what we're trying to present to you for consideration.
Mike, do you know how many people have successfully passed through ICAL and gotten licensed?
Right now, we're seeing the first trickle of, they're mostly MArc students, master's students, and the cadre of BArc students are still going through. We're going to start to see that first wave in the next year or so. Our experience committee next year, the preliminary charges for that committee are going to be to do some analytics around the performance of IPAL students. How are they performing on the exam versus those that are post-graduation? What is the attrition rate? How many of them are moving back onto the regular track? And what is the diversity makeup of IPAL students? We haven't yet done those analytics. I have some preliminary data that indicates that the pass rate for IPAL students is a little lower on the exam, which isn't a surprise, and really not that big of a concern. You know, they're still in school, they're still getting their experience, and the exam itself has changed, but we'll probably have a more robust report in the next year for you on that. And we because it's been suggested to us that AU and ASU might now be more interested in this, we are going to redouble our efforts to talk to them about the advantages. For most schools, the impediment for joining is the fact that they've got to place people in jobs. So they need to have a staff person or a relationship with the AIA component or be located in an area where there are jobs to place. Yes, sir.
I'm going to direct this to Ed because I think he's familiar with it. Ed, in Arizona, do we have a requirement for architects that says you can only gain so many hours in a day, so to speak? Like, you couldn't go to school and work full-time and gain and claim both? If that's the case, how would we overcome that as a challenge?
It's a rule. Our rule 208 allows, it actually penalizes high-functioning candidates.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't allow you to claim full-time work while you're in school, so you can only do 24 hours a day in a 24-hour period of time. And the board, in my tenure here, has looked at the issue a couple times, but not really very concretely. I argued about how the rules seem to penalize high-functioning applicants with my predecessor, and with predecessor boards, but we've never actually engaged to revise Rule 208, which talks about experience and who gets what for what type of either school or experience credit.
Did you just
so
say,
Ed, how would you face that challenge?
So I think what I would like to suggest is, because we have a couple institutions in the state that are interested in this program, and, of course, this is to my own detriment as chair of the Legislation and Rules Committee. I would like to see it, the board put it forward to as an agenda item to look at what we need to do to streamline, access to the profession. And that could be across all professions on this board, not just architects. But I think we can use some really good language, like streamline and access and things like that.
Universal.
I think, but I think that will be an easier sell at the higher levels of government in the state. Right now, there's a lot of states, we're accepting NCAR blue covers from folks who have a five-year NAB degree, and they have, they completed the AXP, which is really close to just about 2 years of experience. And they have an NCAR blue cover. I have an NCAR blue cover, but I have 5 and 3. So I think we need to somehow level the playing field for our own in-state people so that we facilitate their licensure process in parallel with what the out-of-state folks who have the luxury of completing the AXP. So right now it's not quite fair to our in-state people, and I think we need to do something to rectify that.
You guys saying that, Melissa, you said students in school that are working part-time, that doesn't count.
You can't get more credit than the actual calendar days elapsed.
Sure.
You can earn a year and a half of credit if you work, if you're studying full-time and working half-time. You can't get a year and a half of credit in 1 year. You can only get 1 year.
Right. So the way our rule works is you only get credit for school, and you don't get credit for working part-time or full-time at the same time.
So for example, if you're in a five-year program, you get 5 years of credit for your education, but you don't get credit for those 3 months every summer that you work for an architectural
right.
firm. It's crazy.
That's
the way the statute.
Yeah, that's the way the rule is.
That's got a serious impact on land surveying, for example, with distance learning.
Yep.
You know, we've got people that are staying up all night and working all day, and they're you know, they're really, what do you call it? What's the word you use?
Trained.
For the people that are
high functioning.
High functioning, yes.
I love that. Yes.
There is a caveat for surveyors. There's a slightly lower standard for surveyors. But architects and engineers, landscape architects, the other four professions are on the equal.
What about practicing geologists?
Footing. Don't worry about trained geologists.
Trained geologists.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. Thank you.
I need to duck out, John, right, and hopefully I can see you for lunch after this.
Excellent.
I just had a noon I couldn't get out of.
Okay. See you soon.
See ya.
I would share with you that many of the IPAL schools, the way they are structuring their curricula is they are front-loading a lot of the coursework in the first 3.5+ years, and then they're giving them full semesters where all they do is work full time. But they're still technically enrolled in school.
Okay, so I'm employing right now, this semester, a young man from Oklahoma University that it's his requirement to work in an office during either the fall or the spring. So I've got him for like 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Full time.
Wow.
Does that count?
Well, it
I guess that's Oklahoma.
Yeah. So in counting, you know, there's the counting to comply with RAXP program where we years ago got rid of the duration requirement where you had to work a minimum number of weeks before it would even count. We now count 1 hour counts for AXP. But in Arizona, it may not count because it's not considered full time. So.
Maybe he's just for credit.
Well,
maybe that's just what he's
in the back of NCAR by the numbers every year. There is an appendix that compares each state to the national average.
Yep.
And I checked this again on the airplane coming here. Arizona, on the average, takes a year and a half longer to finish AXP and a year and a half longer to finish the exam. So something's going on in Arizona that is even extending that licensure path further.
Yeah.
And maybe it's this. Maybe it's this rule. But again, we would be happy to work with legal counsel and staff on examples of language in other states. And I understand there's also an ongoing conversation with the governor's office about the role of boards in developing rules and regs vis-a-vis the governor's role, vis-a-vis the legislature's role. And we're pretty agile in designing an approach for 55 different jurisdictions, so however you want to frame it, we're glad to help you look at it further. But
yeah.
I just wanted to plant that seed. So next week we are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the river from Boston for our regional summit, where most of the agenda will be caucusing at the regional level, so you're part of Region 6. There will be several short plenary sessions, and then preceding the summit is a day-long workshop with Melissa and her colleagues around the country where they also do some best practice conversations and comparing and sharing of information. This meeting serves several purposes. It allows the regions to convene and conduct regional business, and Ed can talk to you about that in a moment. It also allows people that are campaigning for NCARB office that will be voted on in June to introduce themselves to the members and do a little bit of campaigning. And again, it allows us to float these resolutions and get an initial reaction of how close or how far off the mark we are before we get to Austin.
I think there are a lot of things on the horizon that the board's going to be tackling in the coming year. I know Bob Calvani, as our president-elect, is hard at work on developing charges for next year's committees and maybe starting up a few more work groups on some more topics. Bob's got a lot of energy and wants to, is unafraid to tackle issues of controversy. So we might see more conversation next year around long simmering issues that haven't come to resolution. And but I would report to you that the council is in a good place. We hope that you are feeling well served. You get our update every month. You get our Fast Facts publication every month. And we want to hear from you. If there's something more we could be doing, financially, we're in a place where we want to be thinking about more services. We know state governments are on tight budgets and frequently are understaffed. And if there's something more we can give you at the national level to help you do your jobs more effectively and to help publicize how well you're doing your job, we want to help you with that. We are in a great conversation also with NCES and CLARB. For those of you that are landscape architects and engineers and surveyors around the table, both of those organizations recently hired new executive directors. So David Cox, who had been a longtime board executive for engineers in Kentucky, I believe, is now the executive director at NCES. And Matt Miller, who came from a trade association in Florida, is the new executive for CLARB. The three of us were all together for an orientation last week for new member board members and new executives. They and their elected leaders and us were together at our annual January summit. Because we share so many licensing boards, we think it's really important to be sharing best practices. And I'm really excited about David and Matt's energy and their talents they're bringing to the table. So I want you to know at the national level, we're all friendly and we're all talking to each other. So I'll turn it over to Ed to report out regional issues to you, or board issues for that matter.
As Mike said, we have the regional summit coming up in Cambridge next week. And it really is a focus for the region. And one of the hot topics on our agenda is the Institute of Justice. And we're going to spend some time talking about that, so we're hoping that Melissa can bring some really key points to that discussion. Just so you folks are aware, and you may be aware that this is not isolated to Arizona. These folks initiated a successful lawsuit against the Engineering Board in Oregon a couple of years ago. They have also initiated action against, I believe, the Texas Board of Engineers as well. I don't recall the outcome of that one or what the specifics of that case were, but they are very active in the western U.S. in pursuing break boards. So just something to be really aware of. One of the really exciting parts about being a regional director is we hold pre-board of directors calls with the region just to talk about hot topics for the region, and I think hopefully, I know Melissa tried to get on the call the last time, but ended up getting taken away by a more important meeting with budget people or something, I don't know, but and any of you are invited to sit in on those calls, and I would really encourage you, because it's not just about sharing what is going on in Arizona, but it's listening to what's going on in some of the other states, because it starts to give you insight into what could happen here. One that was kind of alarming for Nevada was the Nevada board no longer gets to keep the fines that they collect. So now they have lost a significant revenue source, and they're going to have to raise their registration fees, their renewal fees. They don't have any choice. So the government, the legislators came in and swept all that money, and not only just swept it, but they took away their ability to keep that money going forward. So I think that's something, wouldn't surprise me if that came up. sometime down the road. So we have to be.
We've never been able to keep them, so.
Well, oh, okay. but I think just, you know, just if there are other, I mean, but we do, we are a 90-10 board.
We are.
Okay, so.
So wait a minute, will we get our $2,000 from a case that doesn't go to us?
Civil penalties, but not administrative penalties.
Right.
And we do operate off of revenue from license renewals and applications.
Yeah. So.
So other issues, interior designers are looking at other states. They're looking at Alaska. There was talk from the New Mexico board members about some possible interior design legislation. It sounds like that may not have happened. They have a title act, I believe, but they want to go for a practice act. There's some boards that are under sunset review. Moving forward, this last time I had two calls because we have the Western region includes Guam and the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands. And so I scheduled a separate call with them because I call them it's a day later at 9 in the morning and it's like 4 or 5 in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to open that up so people can't sit in on that initial call but can make the other call. It's not an unreasonable time except for my colleagues on the East Coast who actually sat in on that call at 7 o'clock in the evening. but I think it's a way of just ensuring that everybody in the region gets heard. I want to make sure that everybody has a voice. We will be having elections at the regional summit. We have four candidates for the executive committee to fill three slots. So that's exciting to see that we have a contested election there. And then we'll also have elections for the chair, vice chair, and secretary treasurer at that time. And we will be reviewing and getting an update on our strategic planning initiatives. We will also be having a continuing education session, and I asked for this because I'm licensed in Minnesota and I need 2 hours of it. We're going to do Jared Zern and Jim Mickey will be doing a 2-hour educational seminar on professional ethics. And so that will happen at our Saturday meeting.
Jared's a great speaker.
Yeah. And they actually did that presentation at the AIA National Convention in Las Vegas last year. So, any questions? Yes?
Do you do any lobbying work?
Do any lobbying
work? Does your group provide lobby support?
Yeah. The issue of advocacy is something that we started talking about right after the North Carolina Dental Board decision came out several years ago in terms of how historically the professional societies have largely done the advocacy work by themselves. But now that the focus of some legislation and even some litigation is right on the role of our membership, we feel that it's responsible for us to get involved in whenever possible advocacy with a small a, which isn't quite lobbying, it's more educating. But we are today co-funding with NCES lobbying here in Phoenix to monitor several bills that have been going through that could undermine the work of this board and what we believe is endanger the public health. So as a 501c6, we can lobby. Even 501c3s can lobby. And it's interesting, I think historically NCES has shied away from advocacy. But Mr. Cox is open to that conversation and sees the urgency around this issue. And we also understand that frequently state boards can't lobby either ethically or legally. Sometimes their staff can. But we also can be your voice when you don't have a voice. We're very careful, though, on a state-by-state basis. We always check in first to say, is it okay if we do X? If it's going to get your board executive or any of you in trouble, no matter how important it is, we'll come up with a different way to do this so that it doesn't blow back on you in a negative fashion. But we've had several workshops over the past several years to socialize our members about the value of advocacy. And even at the basic level, issuing an annual report, doing a very good job on a sunset review, is a way of demonstrating your value back to your legislature, back to your governor, back to the media, back to the public. And I think too often licensing boards have been kind of a under the radar, backwater. Everyone just assumes, yeah, consumer protection, that's a good thing. Well, people are questioning your value. And so I don't think remaining silent is really an option anymore. So that's a longer answer than perhaps what you expected, but it's obviously
it's a good answer.
Something
we're
passionate about.
Yeah.
We also recently helped form a new organization called the ARPL, the Alliance for...
Responsible licensing.
ARPL. And it's a unique organization because it's small, and it is a blend of the professional society and the national regulatory body. So NCEES is a member along with ASCE and NSPS?
NSPS.
Right. CLARB is a member along with ASLA, and NCARB is a member along with AIA. In addition, we have the AICPA and the NASBA, the accountants. So right now, those are the disciplines that are members of ARPO. There's we have to put in significant money every year. And what ARPO is now doing is we've hired a pollster who has actually done some polling of likely voters to understand their position on regulation and licensure. We are going to be commissioning an economic analysis of the value of licensure on risk reduction and protecting financial interests. We're producing videos from a nationally known PR firm to explain how licensure works at a basic level, and basically trying to counter the presence of ALEC in the Institute for Justice, who for decades have just been out there talking with no one responding. So we're very excited. MARTA's been especially involved with the ARPL activities, and we've made a lot of inroads in a very short time, and we're very grateful to our colleagues who've joined this effort. So I want to assure you that there's activity underway to have it, and acknowledge that there needs to be a new conversation, that some states in some ways have overregulated. The regulatory community is not without criticism or not without fault. But there is reasonable regulation and there is smart regulation, and we think we can be helpful in pointing everybody in a direction that makes sense. Questions? Yes, sir.
How many states are in our region, Ed?
It's a big region.
We have 13 jurisdictions.
Okay. Financially speaking, why is our regional meeting on the East Coast and not in our region? I don't get that.
That's a change that, let's see, was initiated. It actually kind of started before I even came on this board, because my first regional meeting was a regional meeting of three regions back in Providence. And it really speaks to the economics of the overall organization, where NCARP staff having to fly them to six different regional meetings around the year just wasn't as efficient. And so gathering the regions in one area and then bringing staff to one location just made better economic sense overall.
It used to be every region met separately in their own region. And then before I came on board, then the experiment was, let's double it up, because we could learn from each other. So then there were three meetings around the country. And then I think about the time you and I got involved, it went to two meetings with three regions each. And then everyone said, well, wait a minute. As long as we can still meet as a region for most of the time, but if we all hear the same message at the same time as a group from candidates regarding resolutions, other issues, wouldn't that be a better use of time? So every year a different region hosts, and so it rotates around the country. There have been some conversations about could there be an additional region meeting by itself. Now that NCARB is paying for the regional meetings, we underwrite the travel and the hotel and everything else, the regional dues aren't being expended as quickly, so perhaps the regions could have their own meeting somewhere in the fall or at some other time, because the funds, I think, are there if that's what the region wants to do. I know Region 6 Didn't you have an educators conference a year or so ago?
No, we've talked about it. It hasn't happened.
So it's really up to the region on how to spend its funds in this regard. And I know there have been questions here about value and what's the money being spent on. So that's a political issue that I don't get involved in. That's what the elected members of boards get to deal with. But that's sort of a history of where we
so
are.
So is Baker still on a CIA director still?
Mr. Baker is now the secretary on the national board. So he's moved up into the executive committee. So he's, I think, running this for treasurer. So I should add that it looks like we have several contested races at our annual meeting this year that are at large positions where everyone votes. There appear to be three candidates now for secretary and two candidates for the public director position. So the public director candidates are from Maryland and New Mexico, and the secretary candidates are from Colorado, Massachusetts, and Michigan.
Thank you.
Questions, comments, criticisms, hopes, dreams,
criticism by you.
I wanted to thank you guys for helping us through this legislative session and, you know, bringing some good initiatives. It's very much appreciated. Also like to ask you to make sure we stay through the end of the legislative session because sometimes we think we're in a good spot and that things change overnight.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Well, I think based on our meeting with the lobbyists yesterday, we're thinking that we probably need to keep them on retainer for another year. We'll have to talk to NCES about that, but we think it's been a good investment.
Yeah,
it has been greatly appreciated.
I think it presents a different perspective on what the board can do.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a positive meeting then, are you saying?
I'm sorry?
Well, I was asking, with your lobbying support, that was sounds like it was positive.
Was that
yesterday,
small A?
Yeah, I think so.
Small
A? I mean, we're, you know, the state of bills today are better than they were several months ago. Is it perfect? No. But as we get our talking points straight and we find allies and build coalitions, I think things seem to be going in the right direction.
We'll give you a fuller report under that
category. You know, not being an architect, you guys seem to have, you're doing an amazing job, but it just seems so huge. I mean,
you just
have so many different groups, and I don't know how you get anything done, but you must be doing a very good job.
We have roughly 400 volunteers from
Please
around the country serving on committees.
Wow.
My staff is now at 115. Our budget's at $35
million.
So yeah, it's big.
Wow, it's big.
But we have a great team, both of volunteers and staff, that are working hard for all of you. So.
And we as a board benefit from having Ed in the region, involved in the region, because I have him on my cell phone. And vice versa.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, we're here for the rest of your meeting and having lunch with you as well. So thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, but Ed didn't get the train geologist thing on, did he?
He did not.
He did not.
He did not.
Okay, so that was item 9A.
Train architects.
While we're in 9, we will go to item 9B.
Got a little train.
9B.
Legislative update.
I'm going to let Patty start us off. She's been very, very diligent in keeping up on the list of bills that are of interest and concern to us. So,
I mean, as you can see, it's been a bombardment kind of year. It's like the planes are flying over and dropping bills on us. I've listed those that touch us in some way. In some cases we already do it, we don't care. In other cases it doesn't really do much of anything. And then some are just kind of crazy and we have to hope as they go forward some rational minds come into the picture. So certainly the ones of the greatest concern are the 1274 and the bill, which is the number 1298 engineering definition. with the help, certainly with NCARB and MSPs, the engineering practice had a strike all amendment that
brought
forward acceptable language, so it's not as much of a concern. 1274 continues to have only one professional member each, one engineer, one architect, so on and so forth. Melissa and I, Melissa's really done a good job at contacting people at the legislature on why that is not sufficient for expertise on our board. Barber's board still has three barbers. Cosmetology board still has three cosmetologists. Why are we having one person to represent a large profession? And we've had a couple of positive, I think, encounters with people whose background is in contracting and they understand. So mostly I'm going to...
Sure. The public member part?
We actually met last week with President Fan, who is a Republican contractor from Prescott, who understood our concerns about engineering in particular, being very diverse and having just one engineer from one given branch may not provide due process and public protection issues. So she had recommended we reach out to Senator Gray, who is also a contractor, and he's the majority Republican leader. Patty and I met with him yesterday, and in 10 minutes, he seemed to also clearly understand our concerns about the numbers of professionals that we regulate here, 18,000 plus engineers, 6,000 architects, and the sheer volume of complaints and applications we receive in those given categories, really demanding more subject matter expertise because you guys are a working board. You members do review applications and we will be voting on the whether the practice standards in one state are equivalent to what we would require here under the new universal licensure. So what he said, I'm taking optimistically. He said, while it may, the bill 1274 may not be amended on the Senate floor, we still have the House to approach. And the numbers between Democrats and Republicans in the House are closer than they are in the Senate. So we may have some luck amending 1274 again to increase, to retain three engineers and two architects on the board with the other professions again being represented as they are now with one board member. And then either we're proposing not destroying the bill because I don't know how realistic it is given that we're just one of several other boards in the bill, but proposing that there be three or even four public members rather than six public members.
What value do they bring? I don't get it.
Andy, what do you think?
He's construction law. He's a construction
law
attorney.
I made that same comment.
And Andy did to the governor's office, and I think was largely responsible for getting the bill amended the first time to provide one representative from each of the five professions. Maybe it was my hostility that pursued it. But Andy was
there
as the voice of, thank you, the voice of reason. I was simply quoting the office. But
Doug Folk also appeared before the committee and talked about his experience as a public member and how
he too was ridiculed.
How difficult it would be for your average person to
Right. So I'm trying to be optimistic. Before the Committee of the Whole in the Senate met, I sent out an email that reiterates why North Carolina Dental Board doesn't apply to our board being multidisciplinary with no market majority among any of the five professions, let alone the two occupations that we also regulate. I don't know that that was read by anyone, but I did get responses from several Democrats. So the word is out there that there is concern about our board and the accountancy board, and Senator Gray recognized that yesterday in our conversation. So I'm glad there is some dialogue. I'm hoping to facilitate more of it by emailing the members in the House when I return from the NCARB summit in March. And then hopefully we'll get some meetings with some of the representatives there, One, in fact, Noel Campbell issued an op-ed opinion that appeared in the Capital Times last week. Expressing concern about the state of our roads and streets. So I'm hoping to
turn to him. They're pushing a bill to increase the gas tax, the gas tax.
But he may understand the need for a civil engineer to remain on our board. Not to denigrate any of the other professions or the professional branches of engineering, but we do have over 10,000 licensed civil engineers. And if we only have representation on the board by a very capable, qualified electrical or mechanical engineer, I don't know that we'll be able to adequately address the applications and the complaints we receive that relate directly to civil engineering. So there is still optimism, and thankfully NCARB and NCWS have said that their lobbyists will be lobbying quietly at the House to try to explain our concerns from the larger national issues, and we are grateful, very grateful, for that continued support. So the word is coming from more than just a mouthy, potentially hostile executive director. It is coming from the professions, and is also coming from the national councils, and hopefully that has some sway.
I mean, you have to put this in context with other state boards. I mean, I came from the New York State Board, and almost exclusively on the board were engineers and land surveyors. So there must have been like, 8 or 10 of us at the table discussing these cases, and all were engineers and surveyors. So just in context, I mean, this board already had a significant reduction in those professions over New York State.
Right.
That's what I'm getting.
Right, and that's the distinction between us and the North Carolina Dental Board, which President Pham has recognized, and I think Senator Gray as well, although there are no health regulatory boards, interestingly enough, included in this bill. That also has been recognized as a political move. That's what I have to contribute to 1274. We're bringing up.
So wait.
The last survey,
yes.
Sorry.
So this Clarence, I'm sure he's a nice guy, but you talked to somebody at the governor's office, said we need another structural engineer. I mean,
yes.
It's really important, and yet they do this to us.
Yes.
Well, who's going to? You're Mr. Structural now, I guess. It's not me.
Well, this is incidental to my civil practice.
Well, and we're not even getting an acknowledged replacement for civil engineer, which is currently required in our statute.
So he stays on. On and on and
if
on.
If this bill passes 1274, it's my legal opinion and Doug Folk's legal opinion, which may not be the AG, although I have asked the AG, about whether any of you can serve once your term expires. As we know, we currently have, even with Clarence, he only has a 5-month term. When the terms expire, you have been serving because there's a presumption that allows you to continue serving until you are reappointed or replaced. That presumption ends in my interpretation of 1274 at the very end of that bill. It says you can only serve until your natural term expires. So that would mean if the bill passes, right, and becomes effective in August, only Jay Fu and Carmen will be legally authorized to continue since their terms don't expire until June 30th of 2021. And we will not have a quorum, and we will not be able to meet and do any business, whether it's granting universal licenses or taking disciplinary action.
We can't come to the meeting?
Right, you will not be officially
you can come.
Board anymore.
You just can't sit here, yeah.
No. Right. Wouldn't you have seven people
there? That happens is not legally ratified.
Wow.
Right. So that's been a talking point as well.
Okay.
I don't know that was an intent in the bill, but perhaps it was. It still needs to be addressed.
Melissa, when you have seven people, 5 public and 2 professionals?
6 public.
Yeah, I'm assuming the governor's office has six people signed up to act as a quorum. Yes, those six plus JFU and Carmen would be the only ones authorized to serve on the board.
Good luck.
May we be public?
When's the next hearing and what committee for 1274?
We don't know which committee that 1274 will be assigned to in the House. It could go to government, it could go to commerce, or it could go to regulatory affairs.
It is going to government? Has it been assigned?
Yes.
It happened. Do we know when that meeting is?
No.
Okay.
It's just been assigned.
Okay, so going to government, so...
I'd be officially retired.
And it hasn't gone through the whole Senate either, right?
Right. As far as we're aware, it has not been on the committee of the whole.
I'm sorry, it has not been to the committee of the whole.
Okay. So we don't know yet if it's on government.
Three years?
I'll let you know when we know what happens on the Senate floor and then when it's assigned over the House, which committee to look forward to.
You're just young and happy for a second.
I know.
And then there are two bills that pertain to land surveyors that
Came up since our last meeting.
So I'm looking at House Bill 2836, and they're amending Title 32, Chapter 1, Article 3. They're adding Section 32153 relating to the State Board of Technical Registration. This is what they're adding. It's called Land Surveyors Minimum Standard Requirements. Land surveyors who are registered pursuant to this chapter shall observe minimum standards of practice prescribed by the board. The minimum standards shall require land surveyors to represent the locations consistent with the best evidence available of the corner positions and the boundary lines. If a land surveyor rejects an existing monument, the land surveyor shall create a results of survey drawing that discloses the evidence. The land surveyor shall file the drawing in the office of the county recorder and provide a copy of the record of survey to the client, and that's it. Our minimum standards right now are much more lengthy than that. If you printed them out, they might be, I don't know, 8 to 10 pages, depending on your font size, I guess. What I haven't really sorted out with this yet is if this is the building block for something bigger and better, or if this is something so restrictive that we may as well just throw all the rules away. So I don't know where it lands on the meter. I can't tell.
It does say based on rules passed by the board, so it opens the door for the board actually to pass rules.
Yeah, I don't think it would replace the minimum standards, because what it says is surveyors need to observe minimum standards of practice prescribed by the board. So we have those. And then what it does say, it adds that every time you reject a monument, you need to record, and you need to record with the county, not with any of the other acceptable locations that you have in your minimum standards, you know, whether it's ADOT or state land or anybody, or the feds. It requires to record with the county.
So I did watch the committee meeting. The sponsor was not there to explain where this came from. Mr. Hack, who's been disciplined by the board, was there and stated to the committee that the board itself does not know what the standards are, which of course we know is not true. So mostly has sent the sponsors information.
I asked for a meeting with the sponsor, Representative Rivero. I have not heard back, but in my request, I sent him our substantive policy statement, which went through law, legislation and rules committee, and which we adopted in October of 2018 about where, if there were other locations and how to file with those locations, specifically ADOT. And I'm hoping he will reach out or maybe we should be optimistic in the way Patty views it, that this particular statute could provide the basis for pushing the rules that Jason's task force has been working to amend. And if it does pass as it's currently drafted, then that would be a proposal for us to say, look, this new statute says we need to come up with minimum standards. Here's our version of new minimum standards, and look at it that way.
So that's the optimistic reading of it, and that's what my mind favors. I'm wondering, I don't really see a limitation on this. The thing about the recording, as we talked about over the past, I don't know, 2 years or whenever we had the discussion about the repositories, I'll use ADOT as the example. They have in statute a place that says this is
acceptable.
You know, so, yeah. So I don't know that this is really. I don't see a lot of negative impact from this right now. I like that statute reinforces the idea that the board will have minimum standards.
Right.
I mean,
right. Yeah. So we're not looking at this as a negative bill. It could be positive, and it could help us get through the new minimum standards.
Yeah, I think if you're able to strike that it needs to be the county recorder, everything else seems
right.
to be good.
And also doesn't say notwithstanding any other law, so that ADOT law still stands.
True.
And I, you know, that's not, I think what that does is, if it says with the county recorder, then it's cut and dry. You know, it answers the question that we had to issue a policy statement on. And if that's the case in Arizona, well, that's the case. I think from whatever date this would be enacted, then, hey, it goes to the county recorder
right.
and the questions.
Right.
I don't think it's problematic to record with the county recorder if everybody knows that expectation.
Right.
So,
right.
The only
vocal concern I have is, again, it's an example of Republican legislators not reaching out to the board to answer questions, you know, for answers to their questions about what we do and why we do it. And we were not invited to a stakeholder meeting to discuss whether this potential statute was in fact necessary. So
the initial feedback I got from fellow registrants was probably just a presumptive fear that it was going to limit everything to this was our minimum standards or this is going to be our minimum standards. And I think just in this discussion, it's kind of cleared up a little bit of that concern for anybody that might listen to the recordings here. They'd have the benefit of understanding that, you know, other eyes have looked at this and this may not be something that's intended to limit anything just to this language.
We'll actually support, we have to go through the governor and get the governor's office to okay rulemaking, so we'll support our request to the governor. Since it says them all, we have to.
Has APLS weighed in on it?
Just informally, I have been emailing Mike Fonder, and he was initially concerned, as I think Jason pretty much described. I don't know what their formal opinion will be, you know, whether they oppose it, because they are concerned about the other surveying statute change that's out there as well. And I don't know when
minor land division statute.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's a tough one. I mean, right now, the in practice, the minor land divisions, specifically in Mojave County, they really lack teeth because the statutes say you'll go through this review process, but if the county doesn't approve it, the people can still transfer their land or still do something. And I want to not get into legal advice here or anything, but there's always the opportunity for the person to go through the process, not agree with the county, and still proceed with their recording. So, you know, it's kind of a weak statute in the first place. So I'm not sure where we're going to end up on that one. I think that the proposed language was I don't want to say more weak. I don't know how to say that, but it was it like degraded the system even a little more. So,
well, there are two other bills I just want to touch on in addition to what Patty has said. Senate Bill 1142 is something that really applies to when a board is up for sunset, and it has been amended fairly significantly since it first dropped. The amendments are better. It is still a bill that will require us as a non-health board to account for many things when we're up for sunset in 2024, but I'm not viewing it as anything to be really concerned about, because I believe there will always be a need for us as a state to license the big five professions, and that we can justify that requirement for licensure, which the Institute for Justice and ALEC consider the most onerous of regulations, because all 50 states, and certainly for geology, it is improving. We now have 33 states that license geologists versus 31 when we were up for sunset. So I think that and the rigor and the necessity of the practice will always require licensure, even though ALEC would love for us to just issue certificates.
This is the Yelp bill, basically.
It is.
Public protected reviews unless you can demonstrate that.
Yeah. Right. So we have, if this bill passes without further amendment, we have at least 3 years to prepare and then a year to respond to whatever sunset factors and questions they have. And I think we can do it like we did last year, or last time.
Did this bill ever get out of committee?
It did. 1142?
It's
passed Commerce and Rules.
It got through Commerce.
Correct. And Rules. So it'll also be considered on the Committee of the Whole, the floor of the Senate, and then we'll go across to the House. So, we're watching that one as well. And then what was the number of the funky one with the... You can only have so much money in reserve.
Oh.
Yeah, that's 2809, yeah. House Bill.
Right.
Yeah, the calculation's a little funky. The concern was some boards build up these huge funds and don't lower fees and just continue to build up huge funds, which really is a concern, and it's an understandable concern. So a bill went through, and instead of saying essentially a board can't accrue more than 50% of its appropriation, it says that at the end of the fiscal year, the board can't bring in revenues that are more than, you can't have a fund that's more than 50% of your appropriation. The problem is the fund at the end of the year is also your fund at the beginning of the year. So not health boards, I think it's all boards on this one, would start off the year short, 50% short of what they actually need to get through the year. Yeah. And have to rely on revenues coming in. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm thinking maybe rational minds are better mathematical anyway.
But who knows? So we haven't taken an active position on that bill just because resources are thin for lobbying, but hopefully the Office of Strategic Planning and Budgeting and the Joint Legislative Budget Committee will be looking more critically at this bill with some concern and better knowledge about how state agencies, not just boards, but how all the agencies can function if they're limited with their budget in this way.
There are also a couple in there that caught my attention. One on saying that the boards can't take action based on rules, just on statutes.
Actually, it's the opposite. That's funky because it says you can't take an action just based on statute. There needs to be a rule, but at the same time, they keep passing laws that prohibit boards from promulgating rules. So how are you...
So violating a statute, unless it doesn't matter unless there's a rule associated with that statute.
That's kind of what it's saying, which I don't really know they can do, the statute grants rule.
And then the other one is, doesn't it say somewhere that you need to, the rules need to be actually approved by the legislature every year?
Every year.
Mm-hmm.
So far it's going forward. I thought for sure they will scream running away.
Oh,
but it did pass its committee. We'll see what happens if it makes it through.
She was paying attention.
Yeah. Right. Now,
maybe
I understand DEQ is particularly concerned about that bill because they have quite a number of rules, which if this bill passes would have to be approved every year by the legislature. And
now, some good news is it made it through the government Senate committee, but it did get held in rules. So maybe they're looking at how viable is that, because they would have to look at every rule of every agency every year.
Every year.
they do an economic impact on all their...
They always say we'll have no impact.
Fiscal impact, yeah.
Right.
Well, most likely is they wouldn't look at the rules every year. They would just pass a bill every year reapproving them, except the year they're stuck with the budget or something else and they forget to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, where are we at on, is that all of them? Or?
Any questions you have, but those are the big ones.
Just a quick question, just some basic from the legislature. Occupation versus profession, are they seeing the difference?
No. They did amend the Yelp bill to insert professions that only said occupation.
Right, so now we're officially all lumped together.
Mm-hmm. And I think the argument was being made that professions are separate.
So it's attorneys and doctors in there too?
No, attorneys are always exempt because we're regulated by the Supreme Court of the state. And the doctors have a lot of money and quite a heavy lobby. So, you know, engineers and architects have never really been under attack. Certainly the geologists and the landscape architects understand, and you guys came to their defense in 2016, but that was new and novel. So we're kind of late to the table of having to defend what you do and why licensure is important. So again, a good time for ARPL to be an incarbonancy coming to the table and saying, hello.
Is this happening anywhere else in the country?
Everywhere. It is.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
The deregulation of the practice of architecture and engineering.
Well, usually what happens is they don't target a specific profession. They pursue broad brushstroke legislation. Usually it's a model that issues from the Institute for Justice or ALEC. And we've talked to them about the fact that we acknowledge that there are some occupations and even professions that don't have the mobility or the access that architecture or engineering does. And they may be justified, but they've got to be more discreet in how they write their bills. And they said, we know that's true, but we'll just let the state decide that. So they deliver a model that throws everyone in the same pot, and then they're counting on the fact that no one in the state will catch this and they'll just adopt it.
Right.
Fortunately, we're now monitoring all of this, so we're jumping in everywhere and saying, wait, time out. And we've been able to beat back most of the initiatives so far, but the effort isn't going away. It's continuing. And it's going to require a lot of vigilance and a lot of effort going forward. But yeah, multiple states are dealing with this. Maybe not to the volume and frequency we're seeing in Arizona.
Right.
I would say probably it's happening with more frequency and to a greater depth here than anywhere else in the country. But certainly we've headed off initiatives in South Dakota, Indiana, where else have we?
Washington
Indiana, State, Montana, Kansas.
Texas, that's all right.
Ohio.
Is that where you're from?
So,
Kansas? Texas.
More of our legislators go to summer camp and sit at that craft table.
Yep.
Wearing their matching shirts.
So when you guys say the Yelp bill,
that's a certificate.
That's just, that's not from 4 years ago, is it?
It's similar, but it's not the same.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But the premise is
the premise
same.
Is.
The premise is the least restrictive type of oversight.
There you go.
So
They did amend it to make it less hot.
Right.
they took some of the stranger items out, and they also reinforced, it put in new reasons that you need to be licensed that this board can easily address.
Yeah, the presumption that all regulation is bad was struck from the language of that bill, thankfully. But yeah, that was what was in the original draft.
And I think Yelp was taken out.
So.
Okay, can we move on?
Yeah.
Okay, we got to jump back to 7.
Hey, Mr. Chair, can I move that we consent 7 A, B, and C?
No.
Second.
No.
No?
No, I have an exception.
Okay.
I have one exception. two of them are mechanical engineers, so I have to have an opinion.
Which one is it?
The last one.
The last one, Mr. Glass.
The only one.
Geologist.
You knew it.
Okay, so we're. Well, I guess since we're at 7C, we'll do 7C. And Gene, you've got the floor.
Okay. No, it's a simple observation. I think that with that application, he did not provide the North Dakota Board registration
North Dakota.
Regulations.
North Dakota?
North Dakota.
That's a new state.
I'm from New York. So that I can't review them against Arizona. All I have is basically in his packet a statement of licensure, yeah, in verification of registration in the state of North Dakota. That's all I have.
Can Rob help you on that, maybe?
So he sent them after. This is, I can print it out.
Well, I need
whatever.
Them.
Yeah,
I couldn't
after,
take an action.
After I put it on board, I finally sent them in, so.
Okay. But with 7A, Mr. Goldsmith, I was able to make a review and saw acceptable compliance.
So do you want to pen 7C until next month?
Yeah, yeah. Good. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Yeah, we'll just pen it until next month.
Is he not in a hurry, though? Because I think the purpose of this universal licensure is to move things along faster.
It is. However, it is up to the board to determine that the practice
yes.
is equivalent.
But we do know that he took the EIT and the PE exams.
Right. I don't know what he took. I don't know what he took it in North Dakota.
Yeah, that was actually my question. Is I don't know that he actually did mechanical.
I don't know if he did mechanical.
But that's not part of the requirement. I mean, I don't know where getting the standards from North Dakota wouldn't tell us that, would it?
Well.
Okay, so that's maybe what we need to verify.
Yeah.
He did. Okay.
Okay, so this is being pended until next month for a review of the state standards. So we have 7A and B that I think that...
I would make a motion that we consent 7A and B and grant those universal licenses.
I'll second that.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, 7A and B are consented. C is pended until next month. Item 8, licensing consent agenda. Everybody take a peek at that. And I think we need to vote on the second half of that. Or is it the first half that we... I think we vote on the first half, right? So everybody...
Are all the alarm agents, they come up every year?
I can explain a bit why there are so many.
Yeah.
As part of my duties, I've been going through and destroying fingerprint clearance cards. Going through that process, I've discovered that there's a number of alarm agents and controlling persons whose current status is equal to expired. This was supposed to be delinquent. At some point in the past, the wrong status was used. We usually expired generally for firms. When a firm goes expired and an individual goes delinquent. And so in order to fix that issue, I went and changed all from 2 years back and older from expired to delinquent. And therefore, this is a great number of them are beyond their two-year renewal cycle and we cancel it.
Boy, are there many jobs in that field?
Is that okay? I mean, are we doing something? Do we have to notify anybody of that? I mean, any of these people or anything? Are we meeting our standards with that action?
We send notice of license cancellation out, don't we?
Cancellation?
Yeah. No,
we send delinquent notice.
We send the delinquent notice, which they may not have received if they were not granted delinquent status because they have expired status.
We need to send notice.
Okay, I think we need to step back on that. Can we do something with this list, not to approve it, or I guess we don't do anything with it, do we?
Right, we can pend it
okay.
to next month.
Yeah, let's just address that and make sure that the notification process is as we normally do.
You see your name on your deal?
I got by another month. Just every month, it's close call.
I can just include this list. I can include both months together on the single.
Let's just pin the whole list for next month.
That's fine. Yeah. We can make sure we send notice as required by law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on to A8A2 then. Certifications granted, and this is a non-action item for the board. It's information only. And if everybody's good with that.
So what's an engineer fire protection?
We have that branch of engineering.
Yeah. Yeah, fire protection system.
You have a license.
You have to have a license.
Should you guys drive? City of Phoenix requires it. Fire protection drawings for gettability permit.
Yeah, and a lot of insurers.
Can you do that or no?
No.
He's not the guy driving fire.
Mechanical engineer.
No, not even a mechanical engineer can do it. It's a high specialized function.
Yeah, a lot of calculations.
Oh, yeah.
We might get a board member who's a fire protection.
That'll help.
Yeah, we see so many cases.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on from 8-2. We've done 9. We'll move to 10, the director's report.
Our budget is in good shape. The legislature will probably not take up the proposed budget until sometime in May. And from what I've heard, they are the governor and the legislature are fairly far apart in their ideas for how the budget should come out. So that may extend session until at least late May, possibly June, but they haven't started talking yet, so we shall see.
Will they give us budget for the membership?
Yeah, I don't know. We shall see. I did want to introduce our new investigator, but I see she isn't in the room, but she was seated next to Mr. Kramer. Erin Correll started with the board in mid-February, and she comes to us with some pretty interesting investigative experience. She was a psychological forensic investigator for a psychologist, which we think will be very helpful with our population. and she
especially crazy surveyors.
Jerry Webster might walk out of here broken.
And she comes to us from the Board of the Department of Education. So hopefully she's being thoroughly trained and indoctrinated. And feel free to say hello to her, and I'm sure you'll be dialoguing her with her in the coming months as you read some of her investigative reports. We do have some interesting community outreach I just wanted to touch on. Someone kindly left me another copy of the article NCWS wrote about our universal licensure. I was interviewed. I do not take credit for the actual word. Thank God. I hate that photo. But we also are going to, we've been asked by another regulatory association called CLEAR, the Council of Licensure Enforcement and Regulation, which is an international regulatory body, to do a webinar on universal licensure and how universal that actually is. And that will take place the day after next month's board meeting. So staff, Rob, Patty, and I are going to put together slides and a presentation for anyone in our sister states and internationally who might be interested in universal licensure and what we've seen and experienced so far with that. And then Palo Verde, of course, has invited us to tour the power plant. I know Jean and Alejandro have signed up. If any of you want to go, do you want to? Okay.
Back of lunch.
I will inform them, and I have to invite Clarence as well. I don't know if he'll be able to, but I think, you know, the more people we can involve, the better. It's an interesting tour. It is the largest nuclear power plant in the country here and not surrounded by water, Gene.
Quite an achievement. I mean, it's something that that really should not go unsaid.
Right.
I mean, a lot of problems with power plants is thermal pollution. Mm-hmm. For those along coastal regions or on the Great Lakes, they have fish impacts and other environmental impacts due to the delta T. But since we're a dry plant, if you want to quote that, we use recycled water from the city of Phoenix. I think it's a great technological achievement. I don't know to what extent the tool will get into that aspect of the power plant.
It's a little
but it's a very interesting operation.
Yeah, I think you'll find it interesting because you are technically minded individuals. So, and you can ask any question you want, like how old's the infrastructure to pipe that water?
Not security questions.
No security questions.
Yeah. How many entrances to the plant?
Right. And this will be a tour where they are not cleaning the reactor, so you don't have to wear special protected clothing. So I think that'll be fun. Again, that'll be April 29th after our April board meeting. And then Jason's going to represent us at the APLS conference up in Vegas in March as well. Is it before our board meeting? I think it is.
It's it's the last weekend in March, I think.
Okay, so maybe just right after our March meeting.
Where are you staying?
We're in the third month of our renewals, so those were lower. But our license numbers remain pretty constant at over 30,000. This month was 30,768 active registrants, and that does not include those who are delinquent. So, and then firm numbers are always pretty stable, although they fluctuate by a few numbers here and there in each of the categories. We have over 5,800 registered firms in Arizona. And that's all I have, gentlemen, unless you have questions.
I have two.
You do?
But okay. If somebody else has questions. I just want to see if you could give us a litigation update, both on the Greg Mills case and where we stand with GL Solutions.
The attorney for the board in that matter did not feel he had any significant updates to give you at this point, so it is not on the agenda in the Greg Mills litigation. I expect it will be on the agenda for the March meeting, and we'll have a substantial update for you at that point. Okay.
Now, have we been removed from the lawsuit?
I want to back up. It's not on the agenda.
Right. So you're correct.
Oh, but it's director's report.
Yeah, but I mean, the item is not agendized.
Okay. And GL Solutions, because you talked about computer updates.
Right.
Does that fall under that?
It does, actually. We are, the GL Solutions litigation ended with a settlement that happened last July. So that is not on our issue. But our current vendor, we are hoping State Procurement and Knowledge Services, who engage them, will just resolve that we are finished with our data cleanse and not proceed with what everyone calls milestone 4. We are finished and hopefully will not have to pay that $27,000 to the vendor because they never provided a solution that met asset security requirements for government-facing systems. So that was a requirement in the contract, and we cannot resolve that otherwise. So,
and that was item 10BB, it looks like, computer updates?
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anything to add to that?
Not really. I've seen, Patty and I both looked at a draft letter that State Procurement will send out, and it looked fine to me. It's just a matter of when they send it, and if there is a response, I will inform you. Okay?
Okay, thank you, Melissa. Thanks for all of your hard work over the last few months here.
Yes.
You've been burning the midnight oil.
I love you guys. You know that.
Love you. Okay, so 11 board chairs report. I have nothing agendized in my report, so we will move on to...
We love you, man.
We'll move on to Assistant Attorney General's report. Scott?
We had that already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first part of this we already covered, the summary suspension question. The second part, I'll keep pretty quick because I'm getting towards the end of the meeting at this point. Essentially, just a real quick touch up on open meeting law and communications. You're all aware, the purpose of open meeting law is to make sure that the board's meetings are open to the public is aware of what you're going to be discussing, and has an opportunity to take part in any discussions to provide you any information they feel is relevant to them. The specific part I wanted to touch on, communications, has to do with the public's ability to functionally take part in the communications. And there was actually an article in the newspaper not too long ago that was very relevant that had to do with something that, in fact, was brought up at this meeting. There's a reference to legislators going to summer camps. There actually is talk about that in an open meeting law sense, because what that functionally is an opportunity for a large number of members of a body to go and hold discussions outside of the public eye. The purpose of the communications part of this is to make sure that you can never be accused of that. And that is, any time there's a quorum of the board that discusses anything that is before the board or could reasonably come before the board, that is something that would have to be agendized and take place in an open meeting. Where that trips people up is in the area of communications quite often, and the big area is in emails. And where that happens to boards is someone will send an email, and then somebody else will reply all, and that functionally becomes an open meeting law violation, because you are then discussing something with a quorum outside of public eye.
We know.
I'm not here.
You can't reply all.
You just erase.
The one other time that can really come up is in serial communications, serial quorum, where, for example, one person emails another person who then says, wow, emails that on the third person, adds their comments, emails it to a fourth person. Before you know it, you've actually got the functional equivalent of a quorum holding an agendized discussion. So the purpose of this is just to kind of remind everybody, and I was kind of hoping that that our new member would be here, but just to remind everybody that you do have to watch communications, and you can inadvertently violate open meeting law by having a communication turn into a quorum discussion of something relevant to the board. Any questions regarding that? Yes.
Is there a policy on the use of personal devices or any device at a public meeting? A communication device?
It's going to depend on a couple of factors. When you say it's our policy, I don't know if the board has a policy regarding the use of them. From my standpoint, the issue with the use of a personal device would be if you use one for communication regarding the board, if there is a civil action regarding the board, your device could become discoverable, meaning someone could then come along and seize it. So, I don't have a policy with regards to that, but you might not want to use personal devices just in case that occurs.
And that's any conversation that you have on that device during the meeting, or is that interpersonal?
That's regarding conversations that take place outside the meeting. In terms of conversations that take place in the meeting, they need to take place out loud and over the microphones. They can't take place outside of the public awareness. Likewise, with research, board staff do an excellent job of putting together board packs. Anybody who comes across information that's relevant can certainly get it to the board staff, and they'll make sure everybody has it. Everybody needs to have access to the same information when reaching decisions. So we really don't encourage independent research unless you're going to be able to provide it to everybody. Independent research is kind of like gum. Just make sure you have it for the whole board.
So basic question on the agenda. When we agendize items, normally we have activity in item 6. It's always enforcement. But when we agendize items in 10, 11, 12, is the public welcome to come to those items. And they can sign up and speak for those items. So if I agendize something in my executive director's report that might be pertinent to, I don't know, a particular profession, I could expect them to come and speak on that. I'm actually inviting them to that.
Yes, and that's why you want to make sure you're clear on the agenda what you want to talk about, because if you're going to talk about it, the public has a right to know in advance so that they may take part, well, that they may be present when you talk about it. Whether or not they're allowed to take part in a dialogue is actually up to the board. The board does not have to let anybody speak particularly. There's open call to the public. People do have an opportunity to speak in. You have the opportunity to place a reasonable restriction on the time limit for each person. But outside of that, the board, if you agendize this, if you agendize under a board chair report item X, and somebody comes and wants to say something, you can say, sorry, I'm not going to allow discussion of that. But they have the right to be here, and I would expect it to be in the newspaper the next day that you didn't allow discussion. But you have that freedom.
Thank you. Sir. Anything else for item, what are we on here, 12? Thank you, Mr. Donald. We'll go on to 13, standing committee reports, L&R committee. It says no new meeting date and discussion of possible meeting dates and topics. Is there anything that anybody wants to add to that?
We have been collecting things to discuss, so with Ed here, hopefully we might be able to create a meeting date. We'll see.
Maybe create a new group going on.
Yeah,
any members
possible.
Drop out if they're not interested anymore and see who is interested.
It has been, the issue has been getting a quorum from each of the professions to come and participate. So that's been the reason we haven't met.
Okay, that I think wraps up 13A. 13B is home inspector roles and standards. Is there anything? We've got a date of March 19th, 2020. Does anybody have a progress report on that? Or actually, that's not this month, that's next month, so.
Several weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, has it been agendized?
We are creating an agenda. We are looking forward to your first.
That's right, that's why I'm asking.
Meeting.
I haven't received an agenda for
not yet.
Review.
Okay. Soon.
Okay. It'll be just like the board meetings. I'll be doing the same thing, and you'll have to access it for
you. All right, very good.
Yes,
a question on that. Home inspectors and alarm people, are they still going to be under our review? Has anybody tried, well, I know you've tried, but anybody seriously looking at getting rid of them and taking them to other places?
I've tried.
You tried, yeah. But nobody...
Nobody, yeah. Department of Real Estate is not interested in acquiring the...
For the committee?
No.
For
the home inspectors?
Regulation of the home inspectors.
Okay, let's focus on the committee.
Yeah.
Here. So is there anything else with the committee? Okay. Item 14, board member reports, discussion on outside national council activities, news and meetings. ASBOG?
No.
CLARB?
Nada.
NCARB?
Nope.
NCEES? We've got a meeting in Houston, April 23rd through 25th.
I'm going to the engineers forum, and Jay Fu's going to the surveyors forum.
Yes, sorry. And the panel at the APLS conference, which is actually a multi-state conference this year in Las Vegas, will be comprised of NCEES, one surveyor, one engineer, Rick Moore from California, and Patty Mamula from Nevada. So we're on a panel. I'm representing our board through the APLS on that.
Did anyone receive a webinar invitation to the APLS for February 27th? No?
I think I did.
I did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They want you to speak?
No. They want us to participate. Do you have the email? Yeah, there was an email came out, I guess, probably to participants in NCEES, which I am, and so is Dr. Angel. So that may be the reason why we got it. But there will be a webinar on April 27th, and we just need to register to participate.
Okay.
Okay, we've got NCEES invitation to make a presentation at annual meeting, law enforcement session.
Yes, NCWS reached out to us because we are a hotbed, not my term, of legislative ideas that and statutes that have, and probably being sued, helped as well. They would like a panel of us to discuss how Arizona is dealing with all of this, hopefully to help.
At the Houston meeting.
At the Houston annual meeting in the law enforcement section to help other states prepare for similar issues.
The Houston is the regional meeting.
Yeah.
The annual meeting
the
is
annual
in Chicago.
The annual meeting will be in Chicago, and that's where this presentation will take place.
So it will be in Chicago.
It will be. At the end of August, so.
Awesome. Okay. ABET, Gene.
The recommendation of Melissa at the last meeting, you said, why don't you reach out to them?
So and you
I did. So I sent a letter to the ABET, administrator, and she had indicated that they are in the throes of finalizing their audit schedule for 2020 and 2021, and it should be released circa June timeframe after the National Council has met. So we will know. I do believe tentatively, if I'm still here, that ASU will be up for review on a number of their engineering curricula certainly late 2020, early 2020.
Okay. Good to know.
Yep.
Okay, Land Surveyor Task Force. The task force completed their initial task, and we've bundled up our proposed minimum standards, our changes to it, updates, however you want to phrase that, and we have passed them forward to board staff, and we're sending them off to whatever process they go through now. So the task force will be on hiatus, I guess. I don't know what you say until we're requested for further action. So that's where we're at. We had a great session. We had a diverse crowd of folks, and they just spent a bunch of time in depth really working through some issues and some language, and I think we've got a great product, and we're looking forward to lodging that forward. So that's where we're at on that. The next item is future board meetings. I have a future board meeting of March 10th, 2020. That would be the next available. Do we want to announce a date after that, which would be the 4th Tuesday in March?
24th.
That's our regular board meeting.
Correct.
The 10th we've secured for possible executive session on the litigation and possible discussion of bills that will hopefully have some action.
Correct, and that would be my point of announcing both at this time would be that you know there's the next one and the one after that. So those are the two dates we're looking at currently.
Is there a time for the 10th?
9 a.m.
It's
9 o'clock.
We did
it at 9, right?
Okay.
It's the same. And it would be telephonic. You're always welcome to come here, but otherwise Kurt will send instructions for calling in.
An email.
Clear as a bell.
I was yelling.
Good. They've got phones up there.
Okay, so those are the future board meetings. Suggested topics for future meeting agenda.
I will ask our lawyer if an executive session to discuss the Mills litigation is warranted. I expect that it will. I also expect that legislation will carry over for discussion in March. And if you wish any other topics, just please email us and we'll make sure we put them on.
Okay. I do have a quick note. Maybe I might be forcing it into suggested topics, but I did see a note in the staff updates about a former employee that was engaged in some bad practice with us, and there was some action against that employee. I'd like to have a report on that, if we could.
Of course. I did submit a pre-sentence report.
Well, not here, but at a future meeting.
With statements, but we can let you know what the sentence was.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank everybody for their participation. I'm looking forward to lunch with our guests. Everybody have a safe trip home, and we'll talk to you the 10th or see you the 24th.
Thank you.
Sir, it was good to join.
Thank you.